just scored a goal and you really, really, really want to show off your sports bra to your friends, it's That's So MLS. I'm Nick Thornton. With me, as always, is Andrew Bates. Andrew, how are you doing?
I'm doing really good. I had a good. It was a refreshingly better week for the Whitecaps. Almost a refreshingly better weekend for TSC, but a not so good week for Montreal.
No, and indeed, on that note, we'll remind folks that we are a North American soccer podcast.
Yes.
With a slight swing of emphasis onto the Canadian teams. Why don't we start with the positives on the Canadian side? Because, boy, Canadian fans don't have a lot to be positive about these days. Somewhat surprisingly, least of all to me, or most of all to me, was that Vancouver beat Real Salt Lake 2-0 at home after a tremendously poor stretch of games and us all saying we didn't quite know what was going to happen. They pulled off a crucial victory, but what did you actually think of the match?
So it was really tense. I didn't quite understand what the Southsiders protest was.
I don't think you're the only one.
Like, there was one. I know they said there was one, but I think it was, like, slightly less banners, and they only showed up on time instead of before. There was a circulation. Somebody was circulating a sardonic chant sheet. I don't know if any of these actually happened. But one that, you know, used the usual Whitecaps chant to say, how we love the manage with efficiency. etc. There's a song we're playing, a 4-4-2.
There's a pro
Peter Vermes chant. So like it was tense, and it to a certain degree it should be tense after a 6-0 game. Do you think it was too much? Do you think it was overblown? That was just the first coming into it. That was the first thing that struck me.
Yeah, it's going to be tense, and supporters have every right to go after management and go after the club, and I appreciate that they made it clear they weren't targeting the players. The one thing they weren't really clear about, and I've since heard that perhaps this was not the Southsiders official, but a few members of the Southsiders board with some other supporters who decided to act alone and make it maybe seem more official than it was that it was very unclear what the protest actually was. So I'll say that, no, I don't think it went too far, but I also don't think it, because I don't think it went far enough, because they didn't actually make it clear, like, what the issue was. It was basically a sternly worded, like, we are very upset by this, and this is unacceptable, and mediocrity, we are coming to the game, we will still drink expensive beer. And so it's like, well, okay, I mean, I get it, I mean, Ultra fans are not going to say, well, we're not coming to the games until we win. But I think you have to make it a little clearer about what it is you would actually like, rather than just sort of vague comments about inefficiency and the club not doing enough. It's sort of like, you know, make a list of demands then. Like, what's your idea? I don't know. I appreciate it, but I was also, I think, perplexed by it. And I'll say this too at the game. It really was totally unnoticeable in the actual game that there was anything of sort going on, and nobody really seemed aware of it. So I'd say if it was supposed to achieve something, I'm not sure that it did.
So I watched this game on demand the next day. I didn't know the result. As I kind of said at the time, I kind of fell asleep from minutes 40 to 70.
Mm-hmm.
But I understand there was there a blown penalty kick somewhere in there? It doesn't seem like a lot happened. Like it seemed like this was all the whole of the game from Vancouver's perspective took place in the last 20 minutes. But it's almost so weird. It's so, you know, emblematic of Vancouver's inconsistency that Vancouver goes ahead with a goal on a penalty kick from Christian Teixeira, who opened his account for the season and was so excited that he tore his shirt off while on a yellow card, earning an automatic second yellow, and was immediately sent off.
Yep. And I also like that the players tried to huddle around him and almost were successful in hiding the fact. Well, he put his shirt back on, but
that was great.
It was sort of emblematic of the whole game in that, you know, the Whitecaps, credit to them, they kept a clean sheet, they got their goals, they struggled a lot. The midfield looked a sight better with Gazal and Tybert in the middle pulling the strings, but it was still just this very sort of chippy play that they could never quite settle the ball, and they're just still looking to streak it out to the wingers to run it in, which fortunately for them kind of worked. And Blondell actually almost scored quite early on, around the 15th minute mark, I believe. But it was kind of all downhill there until the Christian Teixeira penalty. And, you know, the frustrating thing there, again, is just that you're expecting your players to keep their heads. And finally, we had something to cheer about. And, you know, 30 seconds after we go up 1-0, now we're playing a man down for the last 15 minutes of the game. It's completely unacceptable. And I'll tell you this, if something was palpable in the crowd, it was that the fans were absolutely furious, and furious at the player, that you could lose your head and do such an idiotic thing that people were getting up and leaving, because most people were thinking, well, there's the game. You've just handed it to RSL. Now, credit to Vancouver for keeping themselves in it, and rather than pounce on that, Petke's side sort of seemed to really not know what to do with only 10 players on the pitch. And I'll say this, it's one of the few times Vancouver's played with only 10 men where they've actually looked better, and the old adage seemed to come true.
It's not out of the realm of possibility that if you use the extra space, you can overpower the other team. The one thing I want to say is that I still don't understand, and I know this is, it's been a reality as long as I've been a soccer fan. I still don't understand the yellow card for taking your shirt off, especially when, as you noted, the players are all wearing undershirts and they're wearing the biometric measuring devices.
Yeah. It is a little silly, for sure.
Of all the crazy things that players have done to cost their teams games that we've talked about in the last few weeks, taking the shirt off seems like the least of anyone's concerns. But I guess at the end of the day, it's well known by everybody that it's an automatic.
Totally. I agree on both fronts. Like, is it a somewhat arbitrary, seemingly pointless call? Yes, 100%. Is it an idiotic thing to do when your team goes up 1-0? Yes, it is both of those things. But again, credit to Vancouver for finishing them off. And again, they seem to play much better. Mosquito looked much better in this game. And also with only 10 men, it throws the marking off. And this is a weakened RSL side that I just think lost track a little bit of who they needed to be tracking. And then Alphonso Davies comes streaking in, almost scores a goal, but Anthony Blondell runs onto the ball and manages to put it away.
Davies had a quality here and elsewhere in this sort of finishing stretch that I was trying to put my finger on, and I figured it out. Is it when Davies is... it's not the only time we've seen Davies make these huge lung-breaking runs. But this time he's not alone. I think that most of the times that we see Davies with this type of, take on this type of endeavor, he's always trying, like there's never usually a finish on it because he's usually just on his own. And if this is the sort of the new Anthony Blondell presence that I think that it wasn't the only time that happened in the finishing stretch, although I could be wrong.
Yeah.
They were very complimentary.
Absolutely. And apparently some people were pissed off that Blondell finished the goal that should have been Davies. But who cares as long as it goes in the back of the net? And, you know, if Blondell doesn't run onto that and make sure it goes in and for somehow it gets cleared off the line, you know, Blondell's benched for a month because he doesn't do what a striker's supposed to do. But what was very clear from this game is Blondell has a different bag of tricks to Kai Kamara and is a very big, powerful striker. What was also clear is that playing him for 60 minutes and then pulling him off at this stage, yes, they're trying to get his fitness up, but this is a kid who needs to play 90 minutes.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course he's not going to maybe do that consistently if Kamara's healthy, but certainly you want to get him on the ball as much as you can and see his qualities. Go ahead.
I've always been really critical, though, and they pulled him off on 86. I don't think it has to be an either or between Kamara or Blondell. The Whitecaps way is often in recent years to send one striker to the moon alone. Mm-hmm. But there's no way it has to be like that. If you have two players that you want to have time, you can accommodate them, certainly.
Absolutely. Why not have, Teixeira and Davies on the wing, Blondell and Kamara, and maybe have Blondell playing just behind Kamara or just in front. Like, I think the two could overlap quite nicely. Mm-hmm. I agree. However, I'm feeling a little punchy about the Whitecaps experimenting too much with their lineups and positioning these days.
Ah, you're not wrong. The other, what were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to say the other part of this match that really had me infuriated as a fan is that late into the game, there was some call on a tackle that goes in, and Kendall Waston sprints over to Mike Petke and is shouting at him. And I'm just thinking, like, Waston, you idiot. Like, this is the last thing we need. He was fined in the end for his action in Kansas City, rather, mm-hmm. for instigating the brawl, and fairly so, I think we concluded. But again, it's like, it's in the, 82nd minute or something like that. We're already a man down, and Waston has to do better. He has to be in control of himself. He shouldn't be having his young players pulling him off and away from the coach. There's absolutely no reason from it. And it's also really concerning that Rabo doesn't seem to think anything's wrong with the discipline.
Okay, so I'm going to qualify this by saying I didn't know about the Petke thing. Obviously, you can't go run to the coach and do that. So I missed that part. So I was just going on the immediate, like, his continuing to talk is what got him the dissent card. Mm-hmm. I actually thought this was warranted. And the reason why is because the foul was on Alphonso Davies. It's not just that he was fouled when he was trying another one of these sort of long runs. He's pulled off balance a little bit. He's fouled, and then he's also stamped on in his legs.
Yeah.
And you can't stand for that. Like, to a certain degree, you can't stand for that. Like I said, I don't think that I didn't know about the, I didn't see the Petke thing, but all you see, maybe it was just because of what you see on screen, or maybe I wasn't looking at the time or whatever else, but what it just kind of looked like was that Waston just wouldn't shut up about it until the referee gave him the card.
And here's my thing is, a captain should be aware of that kind of thing. Also, Waston's at the other end of the park when the challenge happened. So to say that he had a clear view of it and saw everything, I think would be a bit of a stretch. And if he's running over and screaming at anyone, it should be the referee.
True. Well, I guess like he can't.
I guess he can't, but it's like, to me, I'm just thinking, like, he's off for sure. I think he was amazingly lucky to get away with a yellow card, and I think it's not unlikely that he could be fined again. I totally agree, but a captain has to do better, and they have to be in control of their own emotions, especially that late into a game. And if you've got a problem, go talk to the fourth official, talk to the referee. That's your prerogative as a captain. He can run up pitch and calmly talk to the referee and say, what are you going to do here? Like, maybe it has no effect, but what effect does screaming at the opponent's team coach do?
You're right.
Besides a chance to have you sent off for nothing. I mean, it's just, regardless of the reasons, it was just another really silly, undisciplined performance for the Whitecaps. And take nothing away from the players that performed, but I thought they were very, very, very lucky to keep even 10 men on the pitch and see this thing out.
It's tough. You could maybe have Gordon Forrest sent off again for if you want to have the coaches do it, but it was dangerous play late in the game in a scenario that wouldn't have that didn't have a bearing on the result, and so somebody has to say something.
Of course. And there's a case in point, and leave it to Gordon Forrest, leave it to Robbo, leave it to a, you know, have a coach sent off in the 82nd minute, but not your captain and your main center back. Mm-hmm. Now, things went okay there, and maybe we're riding them a little hard, but boy, oh boy, no, I don't think a lot of people had high hopes for Montreal against a high-flying Atlanta.
Wow.
But this really, 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 really didn't go well, and if anything, I thought people kind of went, oh, Montreal scored a goal.
It seems like, and I don't know if it's a discipline, like, I don't know what if it's about discipline or what. I feel like one of the, I mean, like, you know, I don't know if your discipline goes or if it's easier to get calls if you're Atlanta in that venue. But it seems like if you, one of the effects of that arena, that home arena for Atlanta, is that if you start to lose it, you lose it. There's no two ways about it. Because Montreal defends a 1-0 lead for most of that game until the penalty. And then after that, it all just kind of like unravels.
No, you're right. We haven't seen too many teams go there and perform very well, but certainly, like you said, when things start to not go your way, come back from it. Mm-hmm. And Atlanta continues to show that they just have moments where their play seems really confused and they have trouble keeping the ball on the ground and connecting with one another. But I thought Montreal did well for most of this, and it's got a, you know, alarm bells are really sounding there, and it may not be fair to say this tells the full story of the match, but, you know, they give up a penalty. Almiron, of course, is going to sink that.
It's an unfortunate handball from Duval, who had set up the first goal so nicely with a really low percentage pass.
Yeah.
And then gave up the handball. Bush almost had that penalty, which is like, I think you see an Atlanta player come and pat him on the shoulder because, you know, he chose right. He just couldn't stop it.
And no, and I mean, on another day, if he saves that, you almost think that that could have been the thing that kept the tide in the favor of Montreal, but it wasn't to be. And then what can you say about Kevin Kratz's two free kicks beyond
beautiful?
Just, like, if, and that's where I kind of go, it is a little unfair. I mean, yes, Montreal gives up the fouls, but, you know, this is potentially a 2-1 win, but off of two just wonder goals, it's 4-1. But this is the thing where I continue to see Atlanta still being vulnerable, is that they are a team that is scoring goals by committee, and their strategy at times seems to be less about defending and just about, well, how many goals could we get today? Do you think we got four in us? They're probably not going to score more than four. Let's try to score four. And so as good of results as they've had, where we saw them come apart a little bit at the seams last year and where I think they stumbled in the playoffs, is that they do have a difficult time seeing out games, and that if they go behind, we haven't, like, by more than one goal, we really haven't seen much of them making a comeback. Mm-hmm. And that it's great to win games by as many goals as you can. But if that alone is your tactic, and I'm not suggesting that that's Tato's only tactic, but, you know, I think they're still looking a little sloppy and still like they're struggling to quite figure things out. I know they're still trying to find a way of getting Barco into the lineup regularly. However, if you're trying to figure out your team and you're winning games consistently by 3, 4, or 5 or more goals, you go, well, that's okay.
I think the big issue that I've seen for, like, in I guess a heavy offensive approach works in that sort of environment, in that sort of home environment we described, where everything can pile up on you. The biggest worry that I saw in this game was for Montreal and its defense. We talked a little bit about it, this being sort of a proving ground time, but the defense of Montreal is so exploitable. They're so easy. I would describe them as sort of easy to overload and easy to pull into scenarios where they are not coordinated. I don't know if this is entirely Jukka Raitala's fault, but I certainly see him involved in the issues quite often when they do occur.
Yeah,
they really need a more veteran presence on defense, and they need because ultimately, I mean, even though you know Red Tile is 29, it's not like the defenders are. It's not like these are other teams in the MLS where the defenders are all super young, but it's their obvious weak spot. And as much as you want to bring players like Tyder over, you want to help them advance. You want to help Jason Vargas advance. It's like they're so easy to target on the back line.
No, they really are. And that's for those keeping score, there's now 21 goals given up in their 8 games played, which is worst in MLS. Just behind them is 17 goals given up by Vancouver Whitecaps, and then Real Salt Lake and Minnesota tied for 16 goals given up. So the difference here is that those teams have won games, whereas Montreal is somehow startlingly only third from the bottom. However, DC United and Toronto FC have games in hand on them. So you'd imagine if things don't turn around quick, that will soon change.
And I don't mean to hammer on the people that are there, but if you have a player that's young that has some failures and can pull themselves back from that, then there is a way to make a positive out of a negative. But I don't see any of the players on the Montreal backline as prospects. I don't see potential at this point.
And it seems counterintuitive at a certain point to continue to play those players and have their confidence hacked to pieces by every team that they face, when you kind of need to just steady the ship a little bit and ease people in. Certain teams are very, very good at bringing in young players and developing them really quickly. But, you know, with Montreal, it's a project. And ultimately, you gotta get the minutes right. But they just don't have a ton of depth. And the sad thing is Montreal still has a great attack, has great forward players. Mm-hmm. And shows that still is the promise. But at the back, they just, like you said, they just look so easily exploitable. And there's a reason why team after team after team has been able to exploit that.
Now, one example of somebody who did learn a lesson this week, that is a young player, is Marky Delgado.
Yes.
Toronto FC. A lot of people will, you know, I think so Toronto FC went for the second leg of their CONCACAF Champions League final. It didn't seem like there was a lot of hope to it. And they had a what I would call a performance even better than the 0-0 draw in the previous round against Club America, to actually win away, which was crazy. But when you look at I wasn't able to see the game live because it was on TSN2. But when you look at the chances and the highlights for the second half, it seems like there were a lot of, it seems that TFC did have a lot of the ball, and the chance that a lot of people are talking about that Delgado missed before the game went to extra time. It sucks that it's unfortunate, but I think that there were other players. You've seen that not go in before, and there are other players who had other chances to put the game away in the course of the final 45 minutes.
Yeah, my takeaway from this, the 2-2 draw, is that, you know, it was a good game for Toronto to kind of re-announce themselves of like, oh, okay, we'll play in the league, we'll put some effort in. Right. And Chicago's been up and down, but I thought it was a great showing against them, and the number of chances they had was excellent. The forward play looked a lot better. The interesting thing to me is that, you know, for as good as they can be, is still, again, defensively, it's just gotten a little bit sloppy at the back. And I don't know if it's just a confidence thing, but they essentially have the same back line that they won with, minus Steven Bedisher. And they just look completely... Oh, wait. Who else am I missing? Somebody else left, didn't they?
Bradley is playing in central defense because Drew Moore is injured.
Right.
And Vanderweel...
I thought Michael Bradley played excellently there.
Yeah, no, and we've seen Bradley... you know, that was part of our analysis of TFC's win, is what they in the MLS Cup, is what they did so great is have Bradley drop back into the defense. So it's not a surprise.
No,
but they, but both against both in the Chivas game and in the Chicago game, they were using Bradley as the center, as a center back, and they were using Vanderweel, who is, I believe, a right back. I think they were also using him in that the Chivas game as well. Indeed, they were. So they were using a central defense. Like this was a case where they were using a center midfielder and a right back as their center, as their central defenders. Yeah. So it was a rough. It was a. This is actually a case, I think, where the back, if they had some defensive problems in both games, it's, you know, it's not. This is a makeshift thing. They've lost some players. I guess over the course of this opening round, I also wanted to say just before we moved off of Chivas that ain't it so unfortunate? The Jonathan Osorio misses the first penalty, and it all comes down again to Michael Bradley, who puts it right over the bar, just like he did in 2016 in the MLS Cup shootout against Seattle. You know, obviously he played great throughout the campaign, but it must just be so disappointing because it's so hard to imagine what that was supposed to be.
Yeah, I mean, I do feel bad for Bradley, and I think he catches an unnecessary amount of flack for how good of a player he is, and I get wanting to give him a chance to redeem himself, but ultimately, to me, it's a coaching decision. If you don't know who your penalty takers are and who can perform under that pressure, you know, as we saw when Seattle stole the MLS Cup from them, sometimes you just need somebody who's not going to think too much about it and put a side foot through it and sink it. And I know that it's more complicated than that, but to me, it's like just lining up your star players to take your penalties is a really naive thing to do, knowing that a Mexican side is going to slot away those penalties all day long. I'm not saying necessarily they shouldn't have put Bradley in. I'm just saying that, like, penalties are a different beast entirely, and perhaps they should have reconsidered how that lined up.
They were forced into an unfortunate situation because they had to take Altidore off with an injury in the 86th minute, which is, or in the 84th minute, which is as unfortunate as you could possibly think of. In order to do their plan, in order to keep their plan alive, they brought on Akeche instead of somebody like Toussaint Ricketts, who you may have trusted a little bit more to take one of those kicks.
Yeah, which, I mean, again, it's easy to say, oh, we should have done this or you should have done that, but yeah, Ricketts would seem like a little bit more an obvious choice for a penalty taker, but
that was it's unfortunate the way that it panned out, but it was still an amazing performance in a campaign of amazing performances that will still be like historical in terms of the campaigns by MLS sides in the CONCACAF Champions League.
And if Toronto can turn it around, we've seen that they've come back from adversity before. Uh-huh. They'll be disappointed. I think they'll be disappointed they didn't get the 3 points in Chicago. But ultimately, you know, it's points on the board. It wasn't a disastrous performance, as you said, a bit of a makeshift defense. So Toronto's doing some of the things right. I imagine that we're going to see them continue to grow stronger and start to slowly climb the table. But certainly not anything we need to really get too worried about right now.
Yeah. I watched the first half and thought, okay, good, great. Toronto has come back strong. That's cool. I don't need to watch the rest of this game.
Yeah, exactly. They remember how to play soccer.
Yes.
Elsewhere in the league, lots of games happening. I don't know if we're going to go through quite all of them, but we'll sort of touch on a few highlights. One, the Philadelphia DC United game stood out to me as a bit of an anomaly this weekend. This is probably a game that a lot of people wrote off as thinking maybe not much would happen, but they would have been sorely mistaken.
So I think the number one thing that you could see here is that DC didn't have a lot going. No matter what's going on for DC right now defensively, they have such a good looking attack, and specifically, I would point out that I think that they have great finishes.
Yeah.
Whenever they do score, that goal that Maddox scored was super, super smooth, really, yeah, really nice looking.
I agree completely. Even the goal that CJ Sapong got, you know, it's just an awkward header in, but sorry, I'm talking about Philadelphia now, but in many ways I see the two teams as very similar in the things that they're good at. I think Philadelphia is a little bit better defensively, but both teams sometimes struggle, but I agree that DC looks clinical when they're able to put it together, and 7 minutes in to go up is great. But again, just lacking a little bit of quality at the back and playing to the whistle and also just marking in the box, just kind of basic things. Take nothing away from Philadelphia. All three Philadelphia goals I thought were really good.
Yeah.
Ilsenio's run in just finds space and just somehow manages to cut through the midfield and the defenders in a fantastic streaking run, and no one picks him up. But I'm left a little perplexed by DC United and the fact that they're sitting where they're sitting, because they do seem to show such promise at times. And, you know, these were three relatively good goals. So I'm not sure where you see these two teams slotting into the league right now.
I think that DC really has to figure some stuff out. This is not to say anything against Philadelphia. Where they shone is that A, this was a huge home win. I feel bad that every time they win at home, I say it's a huge home win because they don't do it enough. So
yeah.
So it just happens to be. I would say that DC United's success is up to DC United right now. Like if they can, they've got the pieces on offense together. I would really put that third goal. Unfortunately, I'm not just speaking in terms of my David Oustad bias.
Yeah.
It seems as though Clark did get is getting the looks now. Steve Clark is in. He did not look that confident in this game. It's not like he was the only reason for it. I mean, he wasn't. He's not the person that's not marking people correctly.
No, but, it's a great point. Is that, you know, to have such a great performance last week and then to just not look particularly confident this week. But again, I mean, how confident can you be if your defenders are just not closing players down and making themselves big and preventing some of those balls coming in? You're right, he did look quite shaky, and I do wonder who they're going to be putting up next week, because based off of that performance, I'd kind of go, well, shit, you know, Oustad probably could have saved one of those, and then you get a point out of it.
Well, this is the thing. Maddox, this is what's unfortunate about goalkeepers, is that if you're a striker like Maddox, you could be dropped from the starting lineup and still come into the game and score and prove your worth.
Yeah.
But if you're a goalkeeper that maybe has been dropped, you just kind of have to wait for your turn to come again.
Indeed.
What did I... I think that's all I had for this particular one. The response in that for the third was so good. Okay, so an amazing play happened in New England Sporting Kansas City.
Yeah.
If you, sure did. Were you watching this one?
I was watching this one. And while we're here... Yes. Well, okay, maybe let's talk about the amazing move here and the what happened.
Okay, so the first thing that I wrote down in my notes, you have to watch this goal. You have to watch the first goal over and over and over again, Zapruder-like, to actually understand what happened.
Yes.
I first wrote, Atiba was onside, to, again, reference my longstanding belief that if you play the ball off of a defender, it's immediately offside. But it's even more complex than this. What happens is that, okay, so... an attacker plays the ball back and Roger Espinosa reaches through the legs of the player that's meant to receive the ball and poke checks it kind of out of the way with his foot. But everybody thinks that the attacker has struck the ball, so people just put their hands up.
Mm-hmm.
And the ball drops to Teal Bunbury, and Bunbury has roughly 25 minutes to turn around and put the ball into the goal because everybody thinks the play is dead, but the last person to touch the ball was Espinoza.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't understand how this happened. Like, I understand how I could read it. I could look at the footage and need to see it, but who these players are all standing 5 feet away from this, so they don't see that it is a defender who touched the ball last?
What, one of the commentators on MLSsoccer.com put it exactly correctly, which is that all the players in the league have been told in the age of video assistant refereeing, or review, or whatever it stands for, in the age of VAR, you play to the whistle. Play to the whistle. Let the video do the work. But if you're, like, do not stop. And for me, it's tricky, right? I agree. I also saw it 100 different times from 100 different angles in slow motion, so I can see now clearly that it's the defender playing the ball back, which makes Bunbury onside. Even Bunbury takes a second to just be like, what is happening? Well, I'm in it. There's no whistle. No flag is up, so I guess I'll kick the ball. And that's about how it happened in real time.
It took me a long time to realize that Lagundez never touched it.
Yeah, but it's also, but why are you, it infuriates me to no end to see defenders sort of jogging back or standing still with their arms in the air, watching an attacking player take a shot at net. Put your fucking arm down and run into, like, Jesus. There's no whistle, you keep playing. Like, I'm sorry, I don't know why it's being called controversial. It's very clear it's a good goal. And this is also my pick for team of the week. This is a massive win for New England. Sporting KC has been super tough. And, you know, okay, New England's at home. KC can sometimes be a little shaky on the road. But it's great decision-making from Bunbury. And also just a really professional performance for them to see this one out. To get that goal just before the second half, and then to just see this game out against such a dangerous team, I thought was the arguably one of the best performances from a team that we've seen this season. Mm-hmm. And a really good competition. Going into this one, you would not favor New England to come out with anything. And it's that kind of decision-making and ability to keep a clean sheet against a really good side and to get something against a really good defensive side that says New England's looking more and more like a team that's going to do something this season. And I'm not going to go all MLS and be like, Orlando, are they title contenders? I'm just going to say this. New England looks in very good form. And if this is exactly the kind of game that you need to win, because it gives you a bit of buffer as the season and the schedule get kind of clogged up. So I thought it was great. I don't know. Do you have anything else to add to this? I know we've been talking a lot of New England in the last few weeks.
Well, I mean, if you look at where they're at on the table, you can really see that it is a huge improvement to where they were last year. They're like it's not that they're not always winning every game, but they are they're floating in the top half of the mix in the Eastern Conference, and just to do that is a big improvement. I think from last year where they were clearly a side that had promise but couldn't really connect as often or as well. The other thing I was going to mention in terms of this one is that I know we had a 2-1-0 wins this year this week. The other one was somewhat different. The LAFC one. I don't think we've seen that many 1-0s for some reason. I would have to.
We really haven't.
We don't see it. You don't see a. You don't really. And I don't know if it's MLS defense, but you don't really see a team bunker down and defend a 1-0 win for the victory that much in this season.
And it's the thing that New England has really been able to clean up defensively this season is they haven't scored a ton of goals. They're sitting at sort of average in the league. But if you were to pick, you know, the top defensive teams in the league, well, normally we're going to look at Sporting Kansas City as an example, but it's actually New England Revolution has the fewest goals given up, only second to Dallas, who've been incredibly defensively sound this season. So all the things that we were talking about New England last year and at the beginning of the season seem to have been tightened up. And that has made all the difference. 8 goals given up in 8 matches is a very, very tidy defensive record. And, you know, teams that have scored a lot more goals have also given up a lot more goals. So if New England can continue to do this kind of thing and just stay focused and grind out some really important 1-0 victories... Sure, it's not as flashy and it's not going to get the stories like an Atlanta United is. The difference is we haven't seen Atlanta United really close out a 1-0 win either. So, you know, that could make the difference. It's going to be tight because the Eastern Conference continues to grow and strengthen. But with 8 games gone, to have only given up 8 goals is a pretty good record.
It's something you expect to see more of their opponents, Sporting Kansas City, although I would argue that Kansas City has adopted this season more of an offensive posture that makes them far more dangerous as a club.
I agree.
Other things, just to take a look at the rest here and try to maybe move some through some of these results quickly. David Villa in New York City, Dallas, huh?
Yeah.
Just, I have written down in my notes for that second goal, lol, Villa, holy shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or no, for the third, because you've got the second one was a VAR handball situation for the penalty, but this is another sort of defense situation where, for whatever reason, For some reason, one defender plays it to the other one and it bounces up behind them. So there's just a pocket that Villa swoops into and just picks the ball up like there's nobody there.
Yeah, and it's difficult because Dallas has been so strong this season defensively. And, you know, really what you do against David Villa, and still we've shown... There's very few teams that have really been able to figure out how to successfully defend him. Mm. There's a reason why he got his 400th career goal in this game, and there's a reason why he's got up to that number, is because he takes advantage of people's mistakes. He's a brilliant player and a brilliant playmaker as well, but he also just... He never lets those opportunities go. And if there's even a half a chance or a minuscule percent of a chance, David Villa is going to be lurking there. He's going to find it and he's going to have a crack at it. And more often than not, he puts it away. This was could have been a cagey match because Dallas has been so good and so strong defensively. I know this is getting further down the line. I really do wonder, what does New York City FC look like without David Villa? Cause he really is that team.
Yeah. And
they've got, you know, Maxi Morales is fantastic. I think they've got some great young players coming up through them as well. But you do just wonder, who are they going to be able to bring in to really be that talisman and that thing they need most?
You got to bring Mix Discarude home. Sure. Their rivals, New York Red Bulls, have that talisman as well in Bradley Wright Phillips. We should say that New York City beat Dallas 3-1. The Red Bulls beat the LA Galaxy 3-2 in I think what is not that it Red Bulls weren't stars already, but it really kind of being able to fend off the Galaxy, not just in a defensive, not just by shutting them down, but scoring more than them, sort of ratified that the Red Bulls will be, even though they're in sixth right now in the East, will be a force to be reckoned with.
Absolutely. And, you know, they've looked a little shaky at times. LA is looking much, much better. I'll say this, halfway through the match, I just tweeted out, like, oh, man, Ibrahimovic is really good. Like,
he's just really good.
He's really, really good. His pass to get their goal is just fantastic. And he just does so much for them. But LA just really continues to not have much defensive luck. And, you know, New York Red Bulls are such a quick team. You know, I see Ashley Cole has actually been a real liability this season for LA. And yeah, it sucks to say something against a player who's given so much and really has so much knowledge and experience that he brings to the game, but really struggles to also contend with kind of this new look of MLS clubs. Uh-huh. That being said, LA sort of claws their one into this, and it's only a PK in the dying minutes of the game that makes this a win. So I wouldn't say it's all doom and gloom for LA. No. But I feel like they kind of look like Chicago did around this time last season, where they got in their star player and immediately it made an impact, but just sometimes not quite enough of an impact.
I think what's positive for LA is that they are getting more... you had Ibrahimovic playing beside Kamara, and on that first goal that they scored, I feel like there's like... There's great ball movement right now in the LA attack in terms of like players being coordinated.
This comes with you mean in terms of having world class Ibrahimovic coordinating and playing the ball.
But I mean, like, not just coordinating and playing the ball, but I mean, like, you know, you've dropped this guy in there, and they're working well together, is what I'm saying.
They're working incredibly well together, and I think it is a good pairing because Kamara, although by no means a world-class striker, is very, very good. And I think that Ibrahimovic respects him. You see that, you know. Ibrahimovic doesn't need to be greedy because he trusts Kamara to get on the ball and do the right thing. And so I think it could be a great boon for Kamara to have that kind of confidence and respect from a player of Ibrahimovic's quality, not just in terms of what he can do with the ball, but if he's not going to take every shot himself and he's actually going to pass to his teammates. Lord knows Ibrahimovic has struggled with that through his career. So I thought it was a good performance from LA. Not terribly surprising to see New York Red Bulls come away with the win. And it's going to take a lot to find a team that can unseat them this season, as Bradley Wright Phillips apparently didn't get the memo that he's aging and is playing like a 19-year-old striker, the bastard.
Two amazing assists to set up those first two goals. And he could be like, this is what we were saying, is that we know that he can score goals, but if he can also help sort of elevate the rest of the team as well, it's going to make them very dangerous. Just to your point about Ibrahimovic being, in some previous clubs, a little selfish, the goal was called offside, but I really loved the move. Kamara sends the ball across the box, and Ibra has three people marking him. It turns towards it, and just does not touch it. Lets it rolls right by through to Alessandri on the wing, who is able to put it in the net, although it's called back. But it's a great example of a higher level of awareness of a world class player.
Yes,
But also an ability to understand when is your time to take it and when is your time to use your influence to draw players off the ball and then just not even touch it, just dummy it.
Yeah, which it says a lot when you can not even touch a ball but have three defenders surrounding you. And that's your contribution to play. Dare I say it, that's my major move on the pitch. Run like I'm going to hit it and then just keep running and let someone else have it.
Oh, yeah. The LA Galaxy's rival. I'd done this transition for New York and New York, and I'll do it again because LAFC opened the Bank of California stadium with a 1-0 win that was hard fought and almost didn't come for them. But it's Lawrence Simon who scored again in the second consecutive game. At the very last minute, they had so much. It seemed like they had so much going forward, but they just were begging for something to go into the net.
Yeah, and It's nice to see a flashy side like LAFC struggle a little bit and not just blow every opponent out of the water as we've seen happening before. I'll say this: Seattle looked much better in this game, and they did well to sort of defensively stack up against LAFC and really put some pressure on a lot of their players. Simon is just, it's not just the goal. It's my goal of the week, by the way. I fell asleep in the middle of this match and I woke up and watched another 20 minutes of it and still nothing really was happening. It was just sort of, but it was an engaging match. It was a gritty performance from both teams, just trying to figure each other out. But, you know, to get a goal like that when it matters most, and in the way that he gets it, is just next level. And we talk about defenders not stepping up and doing their duties. We don't always talk about defenders stepping up and doing their duties at the other end of the pitch when it's most needed.
Oh, yeah.
And you could just see what he brings to LAFC and how much they appreciate it and how much they care for him there. So, yeah, pretty fantastic result.
I was going to joke that with a couple of key handballs, including Duval for Montreal and Morgan for Toronto, it was surprising that Dempsey was the only person that didn't have his hand on a ball.
I get the reference.
But he's back in the lineup. I think that is a power lineup for Seattle, so it's interesting to see how that goes.
Yeah, it's still hard to really figure out how Dempsey fits into this whole thing. He's great when he's great, and otherwise he seems kind of unnotable. Mm. And I think I remember the commentators talking in this match about that, of just really not being quite sure of how Dempsey continues to work in this system. I think they'd imagine Jordan Morris is beginning to start and Dempsey beginning to kind of super sub. And because of Jordan Morris's injury, they've had to keep Dempsey on more than perhaps they had anticipated.
Yes.
So I still feel like Seattle's got a bit of business to do in terms of bringing somebody in to add an extra bit of cover. It's great to see Will Bruin putting the pressure on that he is and really seem to be focused right now. But as the season wears on, Seattle's got to find a way to bang some more goals in and capitalize on an attack that was so powerful last season just seems to be kind of neutered right now. And it's not that they didn't have chances. LAFC looked a little vulnerable, and you know, Betasher had a great clearance off the line to spare his team some blushes, but you still would expect to see a little bit more from Seattle and kind of taking the game to them a little bit. And it just looked all too nervy. However, Seattle defensively stayed alert for 93 minutes and almost saw this one to a 0-0 draw in LAFC's new stadium. So, I don't know. My biggest thing from this match is this new stadium is kind of bizarre, and I don't know how many other stadiums are like this, but in the corners from the supporter sections, there's concrete stairs that actually just lead directly onto the pitch. There's no barrier between the stairs and the pitch, which is a very bizarre thing in a modern stadium, and perhaps any stadium, that I was kind of scratching my head at. But I don't know if it's just meant to make it feel more intimate. I'm a little unsure about the tactics behind that.
Well, maybe they'll have to have sort of the Old Trafford corn, like they'll have to make sure that the hoardings go all the way around. I wonder if that stadium has any additional use that makes that particularly helpful.
That's what I was wondering. I was like, there had to be some reasoning behind this, not just that the three fans sitting in that first two rows in that corner could just literally stroll onto the pitch as one security guard watched them pass.
Well, maybe they're just really well behaved. We had talked before about a big home win for Philadelphia, and I feel like Minnesota also got one against Houston.
Yeah, this is a brilliant performance, and If it hadn't been for New England just grinding out a gritty win against Sporting KC, Houston's looked vulnerable at times. But if I had to pick a second best, this is Minnesota. They are missing a lot of key players. They were hit last week, and now Ethan Finley is out for the rest of the season. Sort of their last hope, their last promising player. Now they've got two star players out with similar injuries, out for the whole season. And they just needed to kind of do something. They needed to get this result, and Albert Elis makes it 1-0 early on. Quintero shows up and takes a lovely little PK. Ibsen tucks it away in the 70th minute. I thought this was a thoroughly professional performance from Minnesota that showed me, like, why we can't write this team off quite yet. Do you think it's overstating things to say Minnesota might be a good team that just hasn't had a chance to be good yet? Or is this just kind of a lucky home win?
I love this sort of the plucky game-winning goal where Ibsen clearly has no clue what's happened. It bounces like it bounces off his shin, and he is just like, "Great, I did it, guys! That was me." I'd say that Minnesota is incomplete. You know, they've two of their key players are out, and they have had some years where they've been not up to the level, or that it feels like they're developing and. Could you say, like, is this a good team? Well, the specific 11 that's coming out here, well, obviously they won, but what they're doing from week to week is not necessarily a good team, but it's also, or like, you know, a contending team, but it's also missing key players. So not only are when they, you know, return next year, it's like, it's tough to say already this year that it's kind of, you know, a little bit of a write-off, but it's hard to judge them right now when they're missing such key parts. Other than to say you should have probably, hopefully you could have made a team that didn't need that.
I agree. I mean, I think they've done well with what they've had, and I think that they can continue to build on this, but I agree is that you don't want to put all your eggs in one or two baskets. But in the case of Ethan Finley, like, he's a young kid showing promising talent. It's just unfortunate. I believe he picked up the injury in training as well.
Yeah.
It's just super unfortunate for the kid. And I'd expect Minnesota's not going to just sit and take this quietly. They will try to bring in some reinforcements. But this showed
that... It
does close tomorrow. But if Quintero and Ibsen can continue to show up and they can just get a little bit cleaner at the back, they could grind out some victories. I don't think anybody's seriously looking at Minnesota as thinking they're going to go on some late playoff run. But to put together a respectable season where they're not getting blown out and they're able to salvage some points, I was really impressed by this game and quite happy to see them get on the board against a Houston side that is very, very, very good when they're good.
What else do we have from the league? Are we missing Columbus San Jose?
Columbus San Jose is the only one we're missing. I don't have too much to add to this game. Like, to me,
no.
It's sort of like if you said to me like Columbus versus San Jose, that Columbus won 2-1, I'd go, okay, checks out.
Okay, so the note that I had with this is that I thought on Grella's game-winning goal that he hung back a little bit too. So at first, when I'm watching the highlight, I'm like, what are you doing? You're holding onto this ball way too long. And then he scores anyways. And if you watch it, what he's actually letting the San Jose defender do is completely fall on his ass in front of him. Or not literally, I don't think literally fall, but the San Jose defender comes and overcommits and brings himself almost a yard in the wrong direction before he realizes that Grella is not taking it. Which leaves him clear to take that shot.
Foolish.
Great to see Columbus back on the winning side of things. They started the season with a lot of energy. A couple of unfortunate results seemed like it might derail that somewhat, but this is getting things back on back with momentum.
It is, and you know, Columbus has been quietly putting together some solid performances this season, and they've stumbled a little bit, but ultimately, although San Jose had some good early results, Danny Hosen just continues to knock in goals. This is one where I kind of throw up my hands and go, yeah, makes sense. Mm-hmm. You didn't do a team of the week or a goal of the week.
I've got a goal of the week, and my goal of the week is the first Atlanta free kick.
Yeah, that was real pretty. Real pretty.
It was really pretty, and I think that my team is going to be... yours was New England, if I recall.
Yep.
It's going to be New York Red Bulls. It seems like I often say that I really think that they're going to be a team to watch, and then I look at the standings and realize that they're like sixth. But I'm putting a lot in that basket.
Yes, and the thing is too is that the pieces are working together. It's not, yes, Bradley Wright Phillips continues to bail them out and just play like a damn lunatic, but that they're continuing to get younger players in and show that they're not just a team relying on him, although it certainly helps. To me, they look very similar to New York City FC in the way that they're set up as a team. And I agree. I think they're going to have a fantastic season.
I wanted to just mention, in sort of CPL news, they launched their logo. It looks fine.
yes, it does.
We now have like it's like something like 14 days or whatever until the announcement of the first team, which I think is what people are hungry about. The FC Edmonton, which has folded, had folded its senior team NASL wise, had a sort of exhibition match between its academy and the Calgary Foothills FC PDL team, the under-23s, which unfortunately Calgary won 4-0, but 3,205 fans came out to see an under-23 game, which is astounding to me.
That's nice. That makes me feel good.
And a great sort of a great start to their, you know, push to establish themselves as a presence at Clark Field, both as they attempt to get some favorable usage. It's 9 days, 9 days, 11 hours as we record on Monday night until the next first CPL team announcement. Maybe it will be FC Edmonton, which is all but, you know, maybe there's still some, you know, shred of doubt, but they're certainly operating as an existing football club at this point.
You just want FC Edmonton to have a team so bad, and it's very endearing.
I loved going to those games. I've got a little spot for them in my heart. It's no doubt.
I'm not criticizing. I'm saying it's nice. It's nice to see the support, and I hope so. I hope this becomes a thing. I really hope it does, and I hope that people get behind it. Because we can only bitch about soccer in this country not being at a certain level for so long, and then have an opportunity and really get behind it. My only sort of qualm is that Vancouver won't have a team in it. Even though we have an MLS franchise, part of me is like, oh, I don't know. I'd pay $20 to go see a lower level match for sure. It'd probably be more fun.
We'll just get on the ferry and go to Victoria if they open one there.
That's true, but that's a whole other topic. We can dredge that up another time on a different podcast. Nick has island feelings.
Okay.
All right.
Well, in the meantime, where can we find you online?
You can find me online at That's So MLS on the Twitter. It's very haphazardly live tweeting MLS games. Where can we find you online?
You can find me online at Team Bates. I'm an editor at Howler Magazine, www.whatahowler.com. You can find this podcast at thatsomls.com and on iTunes and other places where podcasts can be found. Please rate, review, and subscribe.
Please do those things. You know, it does help us out. I know it takes, like, not a lot of time. People are like, I don't want to have to log into my iTunes account and to leave the stars or write a thing, but it does help. Bumps you up in terms of your the awareness that you're given by things like iTunes. So that'd be helpful. I'm not going to plead for it, though. But please do it. Please do. Please do that.
Until next week, all you have to do is
keep your shirt on.
So don't get sent off.
Ew. Yeah.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time, and I hope you have a great kickabout. Talk to you soon. Bye.